You're tuned in to the Vintage House Show, home to the original stories of the history of house music as told by the legends, pioneers, and icons. Hosted by Kevin Mega McFall, Lori Branch, and Lauren Lowry.
Feeling a little nostalgic as we kick off this episode of the Vintage House Show. Felt like a little Charlie Coelho orchestra, which it actually crosses many genres, big band, jazz, disco, and then of course Chicago, and we is actually part of our house music movement. But I am excited because here in studio, we've got our guest that's ready to join in on this Wednesday night, Chicago, fairly mild compared to what it should be in February in Chicago. But I am excited to have with me a pioneering figure. Actually, iconic music figure, I would go as far as saying, in this thing called house, as he helped trailblaze the genre. That person I'm talking about, Ben Vaughn. How are you, Ben?
I'm good.
There we go. Ben is tuned in now with everyone who's tuned in from online. On air, we simulcast every show every Wednesday, and we appreciate all of those who join us each and every Wednesday night, 10 p.m. Here in Evanston, and across what has been a global audience as of late. So as we get this show started off, I've invited Ben to join us. I know you've been on the Ben Town Show in the past.
I think I've done interviews on location at other events.
This is the first time I've been in studio, ladies and gentlemen. We've got Ben Florence. So this is definitely history in the making. Ben, I'm going to give you a moment to tell us really about your beginning, not from a musical standpoint, but Chicago beginning. Where did you grow up? Where did you go to high school? Tell us about your start.
Okay. Well, I was born here in Chicago. I'm a Cook County Hospital baby. And I went to a few grammar schools on the south side, mostly. I guess Oglesby, Horace Mann, Charles H. Wacker. I am a Whitney Young Dolphin and Lakeview Wildcat. I'm a Chicagoan through and through. I spent a reasonable amount of time on the south side. I moved to the north side around my second year in high school, and I've lived there until a few years ago when I moved to the suburbs of Miami.
So, thanks for that background. I do appreciate you taking a moment. We always like to certainly call out high school affiliation. So you have both Lakeview and Whitney Young stints at each. So what's it split?
Two years, freshman, sophomore, Whitney Young, junior, senior year, Lakeview High School.
And there are a lot of Dolphins that have impacted and influenced
Blue House in the building
genre. We all have a lot of people that come on that have spent time at Lakeview. Tell us a little bit about
their house music founders and pioneers from Lakeview.
You gotta do some what we call house geography.
Shout out to Matt Warren,
Lakeview,
who was a member of the Social Group Union and he went on to start Sunset Records. And he and Ralph D. Rosario made their first Latin house record. Ooh, but what's the name of that song? Kill Yourself Dancing.
Oh, yeah.
And then they had another big hit after that.
So there is some increasing presence among those.
So surprise, surprise. Like, you might see we got a couple, yeah.
Yeah. And that, I'm trying to remember whereabouts Lakeview, obviously in the Lakeview community.
That's Irving Park in Ashland, right on the corner.
So it would calculate Northside in particular as a place where house music and disco and Chicago's nightlife scene really burgeoned.
There was a scene there. I was living in Lake Meadows and traveling across town to go to Lakeview High School for school. My dad lived on Irving Park in Pine Grove, so that was the best address that we had for school. And I was just starting to discover the party scene developed by people like Kirk Townsend and Batman and, you know, the Doctors and Goody and all of that. And I was just discovering that as I was going to Lakeview. And I fell in with the clique and we started throwing parties of our own, and we were promoting from all of the different schools that we went to at the time. So that's kind of where that started for us. We had a group. There was a group, the Rare Sounds of Space, and that was Dave Riskey and Rory McAllister.
Oh yeah.
Michael Benson and I,
Mikael.
Yes, started Infinity, and then Vincent Sparks and a few other people had Eclipse, and we merged the names ISE, Infinity Space Eclipse. Our sign was this triangle that we threw up.
I've got some pluggers from the merger and of those entities.
The first party we threw was our attempt to bring everybody together and keep the thugs out at the same time.
that was a thing. It was a strategy for sure.
We threw a party called Izod Fest, and all of the kids in our clique were wearing, you know, preppy stuff back then. So we said, look, it's, you know, $5 with an eye if you have anything eyes out on, $10 without. And we had a $200 who had the most eyes out stuff on contest. And Eyes Out Fest at Sours was a huge success.
Give me some context from a timeline standpoint. Around what year was this?
Oh, this had to be 80. 1980.
Okay.
I graduated in 81. So, and I think it was 1980.
Sounds like you and I graduated from high school about the same year.
You graduated 81?
81. Class 81.
Oh, we're old.
Hey, I just celebrated a milestone birthday. I have to give myself a birthday shout out. Thanks to everyone.
Which month?
Like last week.
Oh, well, happy birthday.
Last week I celebrated that milestone and received lots of love. And I appreciate it all.
I had my big birthday in January.
And so we're just like killing the month of the year, rather, 2024 already. We're only 2 months in. You got birthday celebrations from Vince Lawrence, followed by your main man Mega here. And this moment, I guess, is a celebration then for us, having you here on the Vintage House Show, telling some of these critical factual elements of the house story. And so the burning question, Vince, is really about what motivated you? How did you even realize you had creative powers and energy and interests? What happened either at Lakeview or Whitney Young, or was it before that, that you got inspired?
I fell in love with music at a very early age, and I remember being 8 and 9 years old, laying on the floor in my living room in front of my mom's Marantz stereo built in. It was a radio, a turntable, and then you had two speakers, and it sat on like a little credenza, and that was that. And I would just listen to the records, the 45s that my mom brought home. And I listened to so much stuff, you know, the Jackson 5 and Stevie Wonder and Betty Wright and just so much great music. And then as I got a little older, we joined the Columbia Record Club, and that expanded my palate.
Yes.
I got to listen to things like Electric Light Orchestra and the Osmonds and the DeFranco family and the Silvers. And so much music was my company after school. Music was my babysitter.
Did you have a favorite radio station then too?
No, not really, but it was really about just listening to these records over and over and over again. Okay. Getting into every little intricate syllable that the singer sang and every little note of every instrument, just listening to these records, trying to discover the secret to the magic trick that made you feel good. It turns out that my dad was hanging around the doo-wop singers in Chicago back in the day, and he was good friends with a man by the name of Eddie Thomas, who is the Tom in Ker Tom Records.
I remember that label.
And, you know, Eddie and Curtis put out some of the most significant records of the civil rights movement. People Get Ready, Move On Up, etc. And, you know, that was kind of a big deal. And aside from running the record label, Eddie was managing other artists like the Five Stair Steps. And for me at the time, I was, you know, entering high school, Eddie was managing a guy by the name of Captain Sky.
Captain Sky is in the Wiggle Worm.
Wonder Worm and Super Sperm.
Showing my age a little bit.
Wonder Worm, Super Sperm, Dr. Rock, Moonchild, all that. He was managing Captain Sky. And my dad would go visit Eddie, and I would hang out watching Captain Sky rehearse.
For stage performances
and stuff like that. And I just thought it was amazing that this guy I heard on the radio, I got to see them get ready for their shows and stuff like that. And I guess a critical point was, I guess I was around 14, and I wanted my dad, everybody on my block was going to go to Camp YMCA. It was a two-week stay-away camp.
Camp Pinewood.
Yes.
Yeah, I went to Camp Pinewood, too.
And what I went the year before, but this year I asked my dad, hey, we need some money so we can go to camp for 2 weeks. And he said he didn't have the money and I wasn't going to be able to go. And Eddie said, well, you know, you may be separated from your friends for 2 weeks, but we're going to find something for you to do. And the idea that Eddie came up with was, he's like, you know what? We're going to send Vince on the road with Captain Sky. And that was just the best.
A teenager.
I was 14 years old on the road with the funk band that had just done Soul Train, and their record was on the radio everywhere. And I got to really enjoy the process of making music close up. And when I came back from that two-week tour, I knew what I wanted to do with my life.
Wow. Right. There, a star was born, literally, the catalyst. I do want to take one moment and pay homage to your dad, Mitch Ball, as he has affectionately been known.
Yeah.
And we lost him.
Last month. 79 years old. You know, it's a real, it's kind of surreal when someone that you've spoken to as long as you've been speaking just isn't available anymore. But there's so many lessons I learned, and there's all this music, and so many people that have been affected by my dad's encouragement. You know, my dad started Mitch Ball Records, and he was making 45s. And after I came back from tour, I was like, I wanted to make a record. And he gave me a choice. He said, okay, look, you're 16 now. You can have a car or some studio time. And I took that studio time, and I had just gotten my first synthesizer. I put together a group of friends. We made up a band called Z Factor. And we made a record. And my dad pressed that 12-inch up. Well, I had to tell my dad that 12 inches were the way. And at first,
versus the 45.
Versus the 45, right. And he pressed up that 12-inch, and we took that 12-inch to every teen party. And, you know, fortunately, my friends was like, hey, you know what? Let's put Vince's record on and see what happens. I discovered that my drummer was more excited than we would have typically thought. And he played the song maybe 20 beats per minute too fast. A song that we wanted to be 120 came out 140.
Yeah.
So, but we liked it. We liked this song. And you know what? It wasn't a disco song. No. It became a new wave song just by the tempo change. And Fast Cars managed to get on the radio here. And, you know, that excitement amongst our friends, you know, really made us feel like we were doing something. We were one step closer to being Captain Sky because we had made a record. And, you know, back then, the disco DJs were doing disco mixes.
Yes.
Of other local bands' music. And my dad said, well, which DJ are we going to get to help us, you know, make the record strong for the clubs? I said, let's get Kenny Jam and Jason from WDAI.
Disco DAI.
And he helped us with the disco mix of my song Fast Cars. And after that, I was completely hooked.
Wow.
We had to do this again. We're going to make an album. And my dad, because the records were playing on the radio and at all these little teen parties, we started selling a few. So he says, well, hey, we got to go make an album. So
The Z Factor album.
So, yeah. And I had gotten a job at the playground, passing out flyers and doing lights.
Hired you for that?
Craig Thompson.
Okay.
Craig Thompson was the man.
Yeah.
And I had been throwing parties at First Impressions across the street with some success, and I had thrown that party at Sours. So Craig and I, you know, worked out a thing where I could get some regular money and, you know, get to do something I like to do every Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. And that was really it for us. Jesse was DJing next to me, and I said, you know what? All the girls like this guy. I got to get him to join my band.
The ladies' man, Jesse.
And with that, Jesse and I wrote and produced the Z Factor Dance Party album. It's funny.
What year did that get released?
I think it got recorded in, well, Fast Cars got recorded in like 82. 80, 82 or early 83. And then the Z Factor album was recorded in 83, but it didn't come out until 84. And honestly, we had this song Fantasy that we were just playing on cassette.
Yep.
And everything. We're waiting on my dad to press it up. And I had learned about the pressing process, mastering and record plating and all of that from when we did Fast Cars.
Okay.
Jesse and I got impatient. We said, well, let's just make another record anyway. And that's when we started Jesse Records.
Yes.
And we put together this song called On and On, which was basically a fantasy knockoff, you know, kind of. And we went and pressed that up and got that out to all the teen parties, you know. And, you know, I convinced Jesse that for sure he'd be even more popular as a DJ if all the other DJs at all the other teen parties were playing his record. So we said, we're going to put Jesse's name in the song and all of that.
I want to unpack On and On a little bit. And there's often discussion around, the fantasy track and the overlap there. But I'm curious about the process of making the track. Without getting too technical, but we have, you know, plenty of people who appreciate the technical aspects of it as well. But, you know, where were you? You were in your dad's recording studio? Were you in Jesse's basement? Well, did you have a Roland machine?
The Z Factor album,
yeah,
we rehearsed that in my garage.
Okay.
And we had went very quickly from a one synthesizer operation with a drummer to, strangely enough, our drummer was late for rehearsal in my garage in Beverly on 103rd and Prospect. My drummer was late, and Jesse had just bought this drum machine that we saw on television.
Okay.
And it was honestly a toy. It was the Mattel Synsonics drums.
Oh, with the pads?
The four pads, yeah. And the little buttons. And, you know, it was a toy drum machine. And we said, well, man, we're waiting on the drummer. Let's plug this thing in and see if we can rehearse to it.
I just got to interrupt you a little moment here. We've got a lot of people tuned in, listening to the story. I don't want that to influence the story at all, but I did want to acknowledge my sister, neighbor, Lady D. We've got Scott.
Hey, D, what's up?
Scott Lee. And by the way, Chicago Reader DJ of the Year.
Yeah, congrats, Lady D.
Lady D.
Number one, most popular DJ in Chicago. Look at that.
Yes. Daryl Cameron.
Captain also, Sky himself.
Captain Sky is in the building.
Captain Sky in the building.
He's entered the room, and we welcome you and pay homage to the classic that you've created, Boo Williams, as well.
Oh, check man, what's in. Up?
Along with our super duper executive producer, Lauren Lowry, the archivist extraordinaire. So,
wow.
Just need to drop that in, along with the fact that WNUR's annual fundraiser, the Phone-a-thon, is happening right now. And that is a fundraising event that happens annually and ensures that WNUR as a station can continue to be a voice and guiding light for underrepresented taste musically. And opportunities like this, where you get to hear the history firsthand of house music, Northwestern students, as well as community DJs like myself, get to form lasting lifetime friendships, and donations really help us stay ad-free. We are able to host music events, maintain our equipment, and so much more. And so we greatly appreciate whatever you can give via our Catalyzer page, which you can find by going to WNUR.org and clicking donate. Thank you so much for listening. let's get back to house history with my man Vince.
So where were we? We were talking about
this is how you got to
the Mattel Synsonics drum machine in the garage.
Yes.
Well, we plugged the toy into the PA, and it sounded so much better than the drummer.
Drummer just lost his job, and it feels a little. We looked bit at like Jesse and I. AI looked, is doing.
Jesse and I looked at each other and said, "Oh my God, this is good." And we started playing different bass lines from different records that we knew at the play that we played at the playground, along with this drum machine. And you know, sometimes it was like, you know, the bass line from, you know, "Is It All Over My Face." We'd figure that out, and then we'd play that against a beat. And then I said, "Oh, wait a minute, hold on, I can make this trumpet sound with the synth." And then we'd play the horn part from Doctor's Cat, "Feel the Drive." And we had this beat going underneath that. And we're like, "Wait a minute, hold on, this is really good. We need to get a more programmable drum machine." So pretty much that weekend, we went to Guitar Center, and we got this thing called the Dramatics. And that's the TR6, either 06 or 626. It's the partner to the 303. And we got that thing, and it came in a little purse that it had with it with a strap. And we got that thing, and then that thing sounded really good.
Okay.
And you could program whole songs in it and so on and so forth. So we started working out the songs for the Z Factor album.
Okay.
And Fantasy and I'm the DJ were programmed initially.
Yes.
On this thing. And the bass line was made. Then we said, "Well, look, we need to go get a machine. We need to go get a sequencer to play the bass parts, and then we can play the other parts on top."
And how were you recording this? I mean, you stored some of it.
At first, we were recording from the PA into a cassette deck.
Cassettes. Okay.
And then we realized that we could get a multi-track cassette deck. So we got a Yamaha MT-44 four-track cassette deck.
You all were doing good. I was going to guess a Tascam, but
no, this was before Yamaha. This was before Tascam.
Okay.
Put out the Porta One and
yes,
all of that stuff. That was before that.
I'm jumping the shark here.
And it had like a little mixer and a little patch bay,
yes,
so that you could combine. You could take two tracks and combine them, put the combined two tracks on the third track, and we were bouncing back and forth. And it did a real number on the sound quality, but we could stack like 8 or 9 tracks worth of stuff on a four track, and then we would mix that down to a different cassette deck. And we made our first track. We made our first tracks, and we were playing them at the playground.
Off a cassette.
Yeah. The next weekend.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like, okay, man, we should go to a real studio and do this, and so on and so forth. For my dad, after we had enough songs for an album, he, you know, fronted for some more studio time, and we went in and we said, "But before we do that, we got to get a better drum machine." And I had heard like the sounds from Planet Rock and Nucleus coming out of this machine called the TR-808.
Legendary.
And man, we really couldn't afford it, but we wanted that machine. And I have a dear friend. His name is Randy Lucas. I went to Lakeview with him. Randy was like he was 17, but he had like a job as a security guard or something like that. Cause he was, you know, like a linebacker. He was like 6'3", 250 at 17, you know? So he had a job as a security guard, and he loaned us half the money for us to get this drum machine.
So he was a capital investment partner.
No, he just said, "Just pay us back. Pay me back whenever."
It was a loan.
Yeah, just like, "Just pay me back whenever you can." He didn't want anything. And we got this drum machine. And then it was on and popping. We resequenced the whole entire Z Factor album. We had the TR-808 drum machine, and we had the TB-303, you know, strangely enough, the acid machine. If you listen to I'm the DJ from back in the day, that, you know, you can hear that that's the acid machine making the bass line for that. And we recorded this song called Fantasy, and we were looking for a singer. And we wanted somebody who sounded like the girl from The Flirts in Calling All Boys.
Calling All Boys.
And my dad had a friend, Louis Pitsley, who had a famous jean shop called The House of Louis on Wells Street. And Louis was friends with this guy, J.B. Ross, who was managing this lady, this girl, Screaming Rachel.
Yep.
And we saw the pictures and we're like, okay, she looks like Debbie Harry from Blondie.
Yeah.
This should work out okay. And she came and we did the best we could to get that kind of vibe without having the records there in the studio to show her. And we recorded Fantasy. And we waited and waited and waited for my dad to put that record out. And we grew impatient and we said, let's just put something out.
You all were teenagers.
Yeah, let's just put something out anyway. And we had just gotten the Korg Poly 61.
Yes.
And Dwayne Buford, who
friend of Vintage House Show.
Dwayne Buford was running the concession stand at the playground. And after hours, we told him that, yo, we're making these records, so on and so forth. And Dwayne said, I can play piano. And we said, really? Well, we should all get together. And Dwayne's mom was out of town one weekend. And we got together in Dwayne's living room. We brought all our equipment together. And we made the On and On. The On and On record on 4-track cassette. Dwayne playing the parts live. Me and Jesse screaming in the microphone. And really,
inside my soul.
And that's really what it was. And you know, we played the record at the playground, and the fact that people just danced just like it was Doctor's Cat or Nucleus or Martin Circus or anything else really just set us off. We were going to press this record up.
Yes.
So the next, you know, $800 that we got, off we went to the pressing plant.
So, and you bypassed the sort of Mitch Ball machine to get this.
Said we're going. And when we got there, those hopes were dashed against the rocks almost immediately.
What happened?
They said, you can't press a record. You can't master the record from cassette. You have to get it on quarter inch. So we actually had to go to a studio to take the cassette, play the cassette onto a reel-to-reel. Yeah. And we ended up at a place called Fountain Records.
Where was that?
I think Fountain was on 27th or something like that. It was, you know, over near Record Row.
Okay.
And Larry Hanks and Rodney Massey had this 8-track studio. And they said, so you want to record 8-track? And we're like, no. We did everything on the 4-track. We want to put this cassette on the 2-track so that we can go master it. And they helped us, like, EQ it a little bit. Not much.
Yeah.
Pretty much a straight transfer from cassette. We tried to eliminate the noise.
Of course.
From cassette to the 2-track. And then we took that reel back to the pressing plant and mastered it. And we made some test pressing. We made some acetate 1 week.
Yeah.
And we started playing that and it was working. But we said, okay, well, maybe we want to add a little bass or something like that. We went back, made another acetate.
Okay.
And then we made like 20 test pressings. And we took them test pressings everywhere. We took them to the rink zone. We gave Farley a copy. You know, just everybody who was in our little scene of throwing parties and DJing.
Yes.
We gave them copies of this test pressing because it said, because Jesse thinks it's neat. And Jesse was like, you know, that's me. And,
my man, Jess.
And yeah, people started playing. They supported us and it was kind of cool, you know?
A lot of questions really emerged from that story. And, you know, we're doing our best to capture these first person narratives here at the Vintage House Show. We've got 8+ years of these interviews. But one thing that has happened in 2024 is that you put a flag in the ground and we are acknowledging that it was 40 years ago
that we made that record.
That you made this record.
And I think it was like January 20th that it came out. In 1984, we made this record
40 years ago, and
it was like really exciting for us.
Yeah,
and all of our friends were playing, and man, every time anybody back then made a record, everybody played it. And all of the records weren't the greatest records, but that was your boy's record.
Yep.
So like, everybody played. It's like, okay, well, man, Chip, you know, I loaned Chip the drum machine so he can make his record.
Yes.
Same thing with Steve Hurley and so on and so forth. We all just kind of, you know, were sharing the love.
Yes.
And that became like a real movement. Pretty soon, everybody who was throwing parties or DJing or even going to the parties started making records.
Yes.
You know, and like I was hanging out at the Music Box sometimes, you know, and I met Marshall Jefferson and Sleazy and them there, and they wanted to make a record. So I helped Marshall make his first record, you know, the Virgo Go Wild rhythm tracks. Marshall Jefferson is Virgo, in case you didn't know.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just really a great feeling to see your friend listening to himself, his creation, in the party.
And so I want to hone in on something you said that lends itself to what you also just stated, and that is a movement was afoot. It wasn't necessarily well organized. It was very organic.
It wasn't organized at all. It was like, yo, want to make a record? It was really just, hey, want to make a record? Okay, cool. I got a drum machine and you got this and yes. You got this idea. Let's just kind of try to hook it up.
Which I think has also endeared many of us to the genre and the continuation and sustainability of house music. Some may call it the expression cliche, but it really is a feeling also that you want to replicate
the feeling from those parties.
Yes, from that movement.
From those parties. Like,
and the music.
Those parties, those people, it was peaceful and it was cool. It had a vibe. It was dark, you know, mostly because we didn't really have that many lights.
Lighting wasn't necessarily an essential element of.
Well, I mean, if we had like fancy lights and stuff like that, we would have used them, but we didn't.
Right.
So, like, yo, you had the speakers. If you had one Mars light, one police light, that was cool. If you had a strobe that you could throw on.
Yeah.
That was cool, because then everybody looked like they were in stop motion and stuff like that. Just whatever you could do to make the atmosphere more exciting, that's what we did. And these records that we were making started becoming part of the party.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you mean by that? Like, elaborate on that, because, you know, party scene was certainly dancers. It had a lot to do with the venue.
Well, sometimes the venue was just like a house that we rented for the weekend.
Yeah, I remember the mansion over on Drexel.
Right, exactly. So like
restaurants, Sours, and
exactly. So like we hung whatever lights we could.
Yeah,
streamers, you know, balloons or whatever we could do to make the party more interesting.
Sure,
that's what we did, and with that came the, you know, us contributing our own sounds.
Okay.
And after a while, it was like that sound,
yeah,
the sounds that us kids were making became a dominant part of the party.
Got it. Yep. I follow that.
You know,
logic.
So like if you played, you know, Farley, and on and on, and Dum Dum, and, you know, a Chippy record, you know, that was like, you know, that was like a half an hour of a 4-hour event. And then you start adding the beat tracks that were on the other side of these records on top of whatever was popular at the time. You know, you could put a on and on beat track underneath One Nation Under a Groove, and it turned it into the vibe of our parties.
So
that's when it started becoming like a thing. And then it got a name later, like, you know, house music.
Yes.
It got that name later.
But that movement was afoot.
From all these South Side,
yes,
middle and lower middle class black kids making records instead of working at McDonald's.
And there was some discovery, right, that it also occurred, and those experiences were brought into that that movement and framework, you know, people going to parties on the North Side, people going to the warehouse.
Absolutely.
And so this amalgamation, right,
of those parties, you know, like guys like Hans Cherry, and Reggie Corner would come in and go like, yo, man, after we leave the playground, we go into the house.
Yeah.
And they meant the warehouse.
Yes.
And then they'd come to Farley and say, yo, play that shit like they play at the house.
Yeah.
And that's how it became.
Yeah.
That's how it became house music. But it was really just that 4-4 pounding, super low bass, circular, hypnotic rhythm.
Yeah.
You know, it was, some of it was disco and some of it was Italian records and,
yeah, the Euro disco,
friggin' Kraftwerk.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of the B-52s because they had some groovy shit. And
so
this weird mix of stuff.
I want to ensure that we manage time here because there's a very important thing you've done. You've laid the foundation for what has it's been the foundation, the underlayment of this movement, which there's been a great resurgence of sorts. It never went anywhere, but the visibility, the increased audience for the music has occurred. And so here in 2024, I said earlier, you put a stake in the ground and you said, well, let's recognize that 40 years ago, this record in particular, On and On, was pressed and released. And this movement of house had a bunch of starting points that evolved the genre and moved it forward.
Oh, absolutely. It's important that we talk about. It wasn't, you know, everybody wants to say, well, hey, you know, this record was the first record, or I was the first guy to say this in a record, and so on and so forth. But really, it's just the South Side and West Side, middle class, and some even, you know, less fortunate teenagers started making music outside of studios, outside of the mainstream record business that existed here. And it was purely driven by, I can make a jam that'll work at our parties. They didn't have to work at the grown folks' places, those records. We didn't care if the records got played at the grown folks' places. Yeah. We only cared about, like, yo, whether or not the crowd that was coming to our parties would catch a vibe off of this idea, basically, that we had for a song.
So I'd love to challenge that, because there was this whole piece about the radio and the, you know, well, Catholic school versus public school. But before we go there,
it got on the radio because of guys like Farley and
the mix shows.
The mix shows and stuff like that. Fast Cars had gotten on GCI in regular rotation. Okay. That's because my dad was connected to Eddie Thomas, who was a big promoter.
Certainly.
And he knew how that, you know, how those machines work. And then Kirk Townsend helped Jesse get Funk You Up and our songs on the radio as well, because they were connected to the mainstream record business.
And so today, not much has changed with radio, but today it's House at 40, and it's a celebration and a recognition and an acknowledgement of some of that foundation, right? Absolutely. That's been laid. So tell us more about House at 40 and the year-long initiative that you're embarking on.
I have been gathering help anywhere I can find it, because 40 years on, I think that Chicago's place in dance music and the joy of dance music and electronic music is not been really fully celebrated here in Chicago. And then because of that, the rest of the world. I think that we have an opportunity, since we're hitting a milestone like this, our homegrown baby is 40 years old now, that we have an opportunity to elevate Chicago's house music culture and celebrate the creators, the dancers, the event promoters, and everything that makes our culture what it is, because it's our culture, this house music culture here in Chicago, that has changed the landscape of music all over the world.
No doubt.
And I think that's just worthy of celebration. So I'm inviting club owners and dancers and partiers and musicians and everybody who loves house music to come together and, you know, push our culture up. Recognize that what we've done is nothing less than bombastic. From nothing, we brought disco back from its demise that happened to it in 1978. We brought people tried to kill disco, and kids from the south side of Chicago, you know, I won't go into, like, you know, the fact that, like, these are often marginalized communities or people, certainly in a lot of cases, people that a lot of people counted out.
There's a vicious cycle of that.
You know, these people that were counted out.
What doesn't kill us makes us stronger.
You know, brought this, changed music, you know, and honestly, for the better.
Well, you've been quoted in several documentaries. I remember watching the Bee Gees documentary that talked a lot about that attempt at creating a void of disco. There certainly have been many docs since then. Shout out to the crew that put together the Hip House documentary that recently dropped and the people recognize there. What are some of the ways that our listeners and audience members can get involved in the House at 40 celebration and do exactly the work that I think you just called out needs to happen, right? Elevating this genre and its Chicago influence, inspiration, and roots.
Well, we've started a non-for-profit called Chicago House Music 40, and we're embarking on an effort to elevate house music culture. And at the same time, we want to recognize that so many DJs here in Chicago have contributed to this great culture, but not really benefited financially from it. And some of them are facing life-threatening health issues. So we started this fund to raise money so that we can further promote Chicago's house music culture, and at the same time try to help some of our DJs who may need financial help with medical stuff like that.
So not just DJs, but some of the artists,
yes,
some of the producers, remixers, promoters, even.
Exactly.
And so that certainly would go a long way at sustaining the genre, because it would help sustain some of the pioneering figures. I'm also curious about your perspective on engaging the next generation and ensuring that, you know, there's a level of appreciation as well as mentorship and
well, there's
enabling them.
There's a house music conference and showcase June 2nd. It's being thrown by the city of Chicago. And I'm curating a special event during NASCAR this year that celebrates, you know, house music Chicago roots. And hopefully with that, we can expose house music to an entirely new audience. There are events all over the city every weekend. House Music 40 has a Facebook page, and soon there's going to be a website with a calendar so that you can find Chicago house music no matter where you are in the world. And we're just doing everything we can to make more people aware of the importance of Chicago's contribution to music through house music. And, you know, the DJs and producers and artists and so many people that made all of that possible. So you got to have questions at this point. Like, I see all these people chiming in with comments.
Yeah, no, they're dropping in some additional details. There was also a reference to the revisiting of the NPR Throughline podcast.
Awesome.
That was last year that we all got to contribute to. You, Lady D, the Vintage House crew, Lori and Lauren and I. And we were fortunate to also spend time helping the city in the past 2 years curate the Chicago House Music Conference. And I thank you again for doing a fireside chat with the Patrick Moxie from Ultra. That was a couple of years ago, I think. And so it's great to see these initiatives continue and with new audiences, new curators. Looking forward to the NASCAR activation.
Every little bit that we do to celebrate us and what we've done. And there's DJs, there's amazing artists making music somewhere in Chicago today that's going to contribute to the tapestry that becomes, you know, our history.
Absolutely.
Every little bit we do to push it up counts. And for so long, so many people have thought that their contributions really don't mean anything. That this thing that they did, that, oh yeah, it's just a track I put out to play at the party. That they don't really matter as much, but they do. Because collectively, these tracks, these songs, these basic recordings that people made to as their contribution to, quote, the party, have inspired so many people the world over as musicians and artists, but just people.
No question.
Just people in general who needed that little bit of joy in their life. It's really, it's the little bits add up.
What would you leave our audience with based on that? I love your perspective on the collective effort. But what, as we close out this episode of Vintage House, what would you leave listeners with, whether it's the House at 40 initiative, the fact that House is a feeling in the movement, what's next for Vince Lawrence as a producer? You got the mic.
I've got a bunch of projects that I'm working on. Too many to talk about in the amount of time we got left. If I had anything to say, it's just that, hey, house music from Chicago is proof that if somebody has a dream and the willingness to stick at it, that dream can come true and inspire other people to create dreams, to fulfill their dreams. And it sounds cliche, but dreams come true. They do. Don't let anybody tell you can't, because house music existing from nothing basically is proof that you can.
Wise words from a pioneering figure in house music. My guest for tonight's episode of Vintage House Show. I want to shout out everyone in the Vintage House crew that is always making this important mission their passion. My co-host, DJ Lori Branch, our executive producer and founder of Vintage House Show, Lauren Lowry, the entire Vintage House Show Spotlight crew, DJ Mo Mami, DJ Rocky Floyd, and Tanner Wood, a.k.a. My man. We are appreciative of everyone. And thank you, our listeners, those who comment every week. We are going to step aside. We close out Black History Month with a incredible perspective from pioneer Vince Lawrence. Keep an eye out for House at 40. It's your main man, Mega, signing off for the Vintage House Show. Up next, here on Street Beat and WNUR, Old Man Boggs is going to get it in on the ones and twos. Be sure to tune in to the Vintage House Show next Wednesday, 10 p.m. Central. Your main man, Mega, be safe, be warm, and we're out.
So good?
Yeah, oh, it was great. It was
awesome.
I mean, it was authentic and a lot of good information. I enjoyed it. I hope you did. So we've got a crew on the behind the scenes. You can wave to that crew, but we're off air.
Okay.
Still simulcasting on our live stream. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We are going to shut down the stream and, of course, invite you back.
I forgot we were still there.
We invite you back for another episode next Wednesday. And, of course, we're dropping a podcast on Friday. So check us out wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again, you all. Peace.
Thanks for listening to the Vintage House Show podcast. Please subscribe and share and check us out live, WNUR 89.3 FM, Wednesdays at 10 o'clock.